Welcome to the Jess Cagle Podcast with Julia Cunningham. Each week, Jess and Julia sit down with Hollywood's biggest names to discuss their current projects and take a trip down memory lane as they dive deep into their classic catalogs. SiriusXM presents the Jess Cagle Podcast with Julia Cunningham. Now, here are your hosts, Jess and Julia.
A great actor and a great humanitarian and an author and a producer and a director and an Emmy winner and all of these things. And this I love this show that's going into season two, Hentified. She's going to tell me if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
But that anyways, it's perfect, Jess.
Was it good?
That was great.
Season two of Hentified is coming out on Netflix. One of the most interesting shows that you will see on television, and so good. America Ferrera, welcome.
Jess Cagle, Julia, hi.
It's good to see you. So this is not this is an America Ferrera production. You are not in it. Hentified. But can you tell us, so season one aired, it's all up on Netflix, you can binge the whole thing, and then season two is going to come out November 10th, but can you
tonight at midnight up for
it? Today's the 9th. So stay up till midnight and then start binging. Take tomorrow off because you're going to want to watch the whole thing
and rip through it.
For anybody that hasn't seen it, America, what is it? Give us the setup.
Yeah. So Hentified is a play on the word gentrified. Get it? Mm-hmm. And in Spanish, gente means people. So our creators, Marvin Limas and Linda Yvette Chavez, created this word gentrified to be kind of the... to really be representative of like the people in these places that are changing so drastically, and also that at times are the ones who are contributing to the change and to the gentrification, and which really rings very true for me and for, you know, I think a lot of people in my generation and first generation children of immigrants who, you know, we come from these places, and in a lot of ways, that's the assignment, right? Your parents like sacrificed everything so you could come to this country and succeed, right? Get more, do more, be more, have more, all of it. And then at the same time in that pursuit, contributing to the change and sometimes the erasure of the roots that you come from. So we're all effed up, you know, it's like, it's a complex tension, and one that I've lived with myself. And when I read the first digital series scripts, because it started out as like a short digital series, I was like laughing and crying. I'm like, I need more of this in my life, you know?
And is that how you got involved?
Yeah.
Or did they approach you and say, we want you to, you know, back this for us?
Yeah. So Macro, which is the incredible production company run by Charles King and his amazing team, just supporting amazing creators of color doing great work. I had like a general meeting with Charles King. We talked about all these things. And then literally at the end, he was like, oh, hey, would you ever be interested in like digital? And I'm like, sure, whatever. I'm young. I'm cool. I'm hip. I can do digital. And they sent me these scripts and I was just like, I'm in. And that was like, that was 2015, 16, I want to say. And so we made the digital series, and the digital series was a little bit different structurally than the series. The digital series was like a lot of small, short vignettes of a bunch of different people in the neighborhood who kind of crossed over, but not really. And then in the series that we then developed for Netflix, or developed and then sold to Netflix, is based on the Morales family, the cousins, Anna, Eric, and Chris, who you know, they're all first cousins, and they share Pop, their grandpa, the patriarch of the family. And he and his taco shop in Boyle Heights are kind of the center of the family life and world. And that all gets thrown into, you know, upheaval with the onslaught of gentrification in their neighborhood, and him just fighting to stay open, to stay alive. And then at the end of season one, Oh, well, I guess I shouldn't. I won't give it away. But there's a big cliffhanger at season at the end of season one. That we come back in with right away in season two.
Well, I loved there's because I love the character of Anna. I mean, everyone is fascinating in their own right. But I love Anna because I think she really shows what you were talking about of being a person that has internal conflict in the sense of trying to assimilate with what she's doing in art and trying to push her narrative forward, but also wanting to stay in the roots of her community. And there's an episode in season one called The Mural, which I thought was so amazing, where she's hired by people that are gentrifying the neighborhood, but allowing her to do her art. And she wants to represent queer love, but also there's people against it in the neighborhood. And I thought it was such a great episode to show how much more internal struggle there is than you actually think, even with just trying to do your own passions.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that is very much the, you know, the struggle for any of us who straddle many identities. Like, you know, she is a brown queer woman and Latina woman. And so, yes, she identifies as Latina. She is in love with her neighborhood and the progress of her people. And she's also queer. And that, you know, the acceptance of her queer identity is a very tough subject in her Latin community, in her Latino community. And the subject of her Latinidad and her brownness is a tough subject in her queer community. They don't understand or fully see and accept and really, you know, make space for that part of her. And so in both worlds, she's trying to straddle and not compromise herself. And it's a challenge. It's a challenge. And I think something that a lot of people can relate to, you know, just straddling different worlds and different aspects of ourselves.
What was it like? So your both of your parents are from Honduras, right?
They
but
are,
you were,
yep.
But
born
raised,
in Los Angeles.
But raised in Woodland. I mean, this is the show is about Boyle Heights, right?
Yeah.
Which is, you know, but you were raised in Woodland Hills, which I would assume is a very kind of white area when you were growing
up. Yeah, I was. Well, it was mixed. I mean, I was born in East LA. It's a song about it. And I was raised in like, for the first kind of half of my childhood in Canoga Park, which actually was a very brown minority community. And then moved to a more, somewhat more affluent community, I would say lower middle class, which was a lot of actually first generation immigrants. Like my friends were like first generation Chinese, first generation Filipino, first generation Arab. But we went to school, I went to public schools that were predominantly white. And I lived in neighborhoods that, well, you know, we were surrounded by predominantly white and actually very Jewish communities. And so, you know, all of that to say that my Latina identity was not at the forefront of my childhood. And in a lot of ways, like the cousin Chris, he's like, he's like the whitewashed one. He's the one who like his dad moved him to Ohio and, you know, he comes back to like learn his roots. Like, unfortunately, that's me. I'm that one. I'm the annoying one who like I had to find my way back to my Latina identity. Like, you know, I was raised in a lot of ways to prioritize like assimilation and to prioritize success. And success often meant assimilating and it meant kind of hiding anything that made you feel other and different and really blending in. And for me, that was, you know, a very white washed kind of existence. And so in a lot of ways, Chris's storyline and getting to tell this story is it's a very personal one because I now do feel so identified as a Latina, but that wasn't really encouraged for me growing up.
Well, one of the great things about the show is that it, you know, there's been an increase in visibility. We still haven't gone far enough, but real visibility for, you know, someone like you growing up where there was a mix of cultures at home, right? Mm-hmm. There was a mix of cultures, and visibility of people living in that mix of cultures is still pretty rare. You know, mm-hmm. we tend to go to extremes, and that's what this show really, really shows, you know, and not just the mix of cultures, but also the struggle in being true to who you really are.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, we've gotten responses from all kinds of people. Like, I cry every time I get tagged in the videos of, like, you know, kids watching it with their parents and their grandparents, like someone my age watching it with their kids, because they want, you know, the multi-generational viewing of it. It is so true to the Latino culture that I love that people watch it across generations. And I've also been approached a lot by people outside the Latino community who really appreciate it and really enjoy it. And like, and why shouldn't they? I grew up my whole life watching other people and other cultures and learning how to, you know, imagine myself as, you know, Reese Witherspoon and Natalie Portman and Julia Roberts and, you know, Will Smith. And like, why shouldn't other human beings be able to watch a story about, you know, that's the gift of art, is that it gives us the window into that world. And so, you know, I want people to feel the joy of the show, because we make it with joy. We are celebrating the people we love and the communities we love. And really, you know, that what I loved about the way Marvin and Linda approached it from the beginning was that they wrote it with humor and with style. And yes, it is rooted in very real life issues, but like, I gotta say, like, I think we deserve more than just like the really sad, grainy stories that get told over and over again. Like, we deserve to be happy and to have joy and love and all of that.
Well, I didn't realize it until I watched the season 2 premiere, where I saw, oh, directed by America Ferrer. And I was like, oh, nail polish emoji, how exciting. And then I realized, no, you directed a lot of episodes for the series, but also back to Superstore. But I was curious if that was something that you felt like you wanted to do out of necessity of being part of the larger, telling the fuller story, or if you had always been like, no, that was a direction I always wanted to go in, or did it feel like it had a much different purpose as you got further into the business?
You know, it's interesting. I never felt like that was a direction I was going in. I always loved being a part of the deeper collaboration, and there are limits to that as an actor, you know, and every project is different, and how much they want to hear from you and get your feedback is different. And you really have no control over the final thing. You know, you come in, you do your work, and someone else puts it together. But, I think I started to realize on Superstore that I really wanted to give it a shot, and I had a hunch that I would like it and that I'd be really good at it. And I was right on both accounts. I am very good at it, and I do love it very, very much. But the thing that kind of put me over the edge was how much it scared me. Like, I'm somebody who's like, oh, I'm afraid. That's interesting. Why am I afraid? You know? And I remember the moment I thought, oh, maybe I could ask to direct, and then all the fear came up, I was like, oh, wow. Now I have to do it, because there's something in this that is like a block for me, right? Something deeply ingrained that feels like I don't belong there, or I don't deserve it, or I won't be good at it, or I've never really seen someone exactly like me doing that. And the thing is that that did begin to change. And I was starting to see, like, my friend Eva Longoria get behind the camera, you know, my friend Amy Poehler get behind the camera, my friend Amber Tamblyn get behind the camera, like, and seeing women who were actresses and in front of the camera take that step. And they were such a huge part of saying, do it, do it, do it. And like, you don't have to be perfect, and you are ready. You've made over 100 hours of television. You've been working for 20 years. What are you waiting for? You know, you can do this. And we need that. And I needed that. I think I kind of asked myself, if I, with 20 years of experience, with all this experience under my belt, with access and with, you know, with every opportunity that I have, if I'm afraid to step into that position, what must other people like me feel? And so in a way, the impulse to direct was, I want to, but then the kind of shove I needed was the, like, if you can't do it, how can we go out there and expect other people with so far less support to do it, you know? And so seeing those women do it meant so much to me. So that was really the thing of, like, okay, I got to do it because we need more of us doing it. So yeah, did that answer the question?
Yes, I think so.
And aren't you about to do your first movie? Directing?
I am, yeah. I'm about to direct my first feature film.
And it's a YA novel, right?
Yeah. It's a YA novel called I'm Not Your Perfect Mexican Daughter. It's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful book that has a huge following and has been on bestseller list since it came out four years ago. And I fell in love with the book when I read it. And then, kind of full circle, Macro had gotten on board and the script was being adapted by Linda Yvette Chavez. And I was like, wait a second, I know her. And I knew the author from before. And so I knew so many people involved in the project and loved it so much. And for me, again, as a director, like, it's not that I'm like, I have to have a career as a director. I mean, I think actually the most freeing thing about it is that I don't have anything attached to that. Not the way, like, right, as an actress since I was five, I'm like, these are the goals, right? So everything has so much importance. As a director, it's something that has happened so natural and organically that directing Mexican Daughter wasn't like about taking on a challenge or anything. It was about, oh, I can tell this story. This one I can tell. This one I know I have a point of view and a perspective and something to say. And that's been the driving force of it. And I've been directing it because we've been already kind of writing the script and prepping the concepts and the visuals and the ideas. And so I'm sort of in it, but we will go into production next year.
And are you, I love the mystery kind of at the center of that story, which is...
Did you read it? Have you read the book?
I know what it's about. And it's on my list to read, although now maybe I want to, like, wait until the movie comes out so I don't. So yeah. I don't know how it is, but it's an amazing mystery, which is great.
Yeah, no, I mean, and the thing about it is, like, again, when I read this book, what struck me was, like, I've never seen us portrayed this way, the way that I did with Hentified. You know, it was like, oh, this girl is, like, she's 17. Actually, in the book, she goes from, like, I think from 15 to 17, but she's, like, doesn't care what people think about her. She says all the wrong things. She's punk. She's kind of a bitch. Like, she's not likable. She doesn't give a shit if you like her. Like, she's angry, but she's also smart and beautiful in every way and artistic, and her mind is amazing. And she doesn't fit any stereotype of the, like, 17-year-old Latina that I've been watching my whole life, you know, and having to kind of read and take in and internalize my whole life. And so for me, it's just so exciting that we get to, like, again, you know, tell a version of our story that just has not had space before and that we get to do with this one.
America, I, like a creep, noticed that you've been married for 10 years. So naturally, like a creep, I went and was like, America Ferrera wedding. And I, like a creep, looked at a picture from your wedding. But we noticed that Judith Light officiated your wedding, who we had on the show yesterday, and we consider a very close friend of our show. And I got so amped up. And I was just so curious about, you know, obviously you guys have a close friendship to have her officiate your wedding, and we're co-stars, but... you know, what does she mean to you?
Judith, I tell everybody she's my mother, and people are like, what? I'm like, well, not like I didn't come out of her body, but she is a mother to me. I love her so dearly. And if you would have told like my little self that freaking Angela from Who's the Boss was going to officiate my wedding. But then here's the kicker. We got married at Vanessa Williams's house in New York. Yes. Well, this was like prime or like right after Ugly Betty, right? So we, you know, we're still a family. Our Ugly Betty cast is like such family. And when I told Vanessa that I was engaged, she just started sending me pictures of her backyard. She's like, this is where you'll get married. And I didn't think she was serious, but she was. And we got married at Vanessa's house. Judith officiated. And I think every main cast member was there. I think Ashley Jensen at the last minute couldn't get to us from the UK. But everybody else was there. And it was amazing. And all that to say, like, Judith, there's no one in the world who's more aptly named, right? She just is light. She's just the best. I love her to death.
Yeah.
And what was it? What has it been like having a 1.5-year-old during such a weird time? And maybe a great time to have a baby in some ways because there's just so much time at home, but also you're trapped a lot.
Yeah. I mean, I think having a baby is an isolating experience anyway. On the best day. And then, you know, it was early. I was 7 months pregnant when shutdown happened. And she came a month early. So she came in May, like beginning of May. And that was still a scary time, you know, scary time to be in hospitals. Protocols were changing. Like, was my husband going to be able to be with me in postpartum or not? Like, it was, you know, and hospitals were just scary places to be. So I was pretty stressed out about it, leading into it. But, you know, thank goodness everything was great. She was born healthy. I was okay. Like, everything was great. And then, you know, I didn't have any of the like support, whether from like family, friends, or like, you know, hired help to get through those really brutal early weeks. And I had a C-section. So I was also like recovering from a C-section, had a toddler, a newborn baby, breastfeeding, and like no help. I mean, my husband was helpful. He's very helpful. But, And this is, he'll hate that I tell this story, but I'm going to tell it anyway. He thought he had a COVID scare early. So I think I was home from the hospital 1 week with a brand new baby and he got sick and he took a test, but it was back when you had to wait 72 hours for, you know, where it wasn't easy to get a test or results. He spent 72 hours locked up in a room. Sleeping while I like was up with the baby all night with the I mean, like, I wanted to kill him. And I was like the second those results came in, I like knocked on the door. I'm like, you don't have COVID. Get out. Take the baby. I'm taking a bath. Like, I don't want to see anyone for 24 hours. And you know, but I like will never forgive him for abandoning me for 72 hours, but you know, he was doing the thing, I guess.
He was, but did he come out and he was like, America, you've really got to see Succession. I've been binging it, enjoying it in my
I think he wanted to live. He didn't have a death wish, so he didn't brag about whatever he binged. But I also had to like take him food. So I'm like caring for our children, newborn, breastfeeding. He's sleeping all day. And then I'm like, dropping meals off for him at the door. I like, it was, it's, you know, it's a real testament to our love that he survived that.
He's a very, and a very talented artist. He's a great painter. Yes.
Thank you. Yeah, he is. Yeah. He's a very, he makes beautiful paintings. Yeah. Thank you.
What is the, I'm so excited about We Crashed because ever since I saw that documentary on WeWorks, I was just obsessed with Adam Neumann and the whole crazy nonsense. And you're doing We Crash, which is about the rise and fall of WeWorks for Apple TV Plus. And I just wonder what your take on that whole situation is.
I mean, it's fascinating. It's really fascinating. I was really excited to be a part of it because I feel like that whole, you know, the phenomenon of like the unicorn tech company or like so-called tech company kind of blinding everyone to what's real, I think is a really, really important thing for us to understand, right? I think it holds a lot and says a lot about who we are and this country and capitalism and just, you know, what drives us, that we are willing to kind of live in our hoped for reality that doesn't like match anything real. The very well-intentioned, very smart people who got caught up in it. Do you know what I mean? That it wasn't just like those things don't just happen because one person is a megalomaniac. They happen because a bunch of other people are like, maybe he's onto something, you know?
Yeah, enabling them and buying into the insanity. Yeah.
Well, and we've seen We've seen that play out, right, in so many different ways in our culture in the last decade of like these moments where these like figures that people are willing to just believe in, you know, despite reality, are sort of unmasked for what they are. And then it's not even about them. It's about what does that say about us, that we all got taken in, right? And so I think it's a really, really fascinating story that says a lot about who we are in this country and what drives us.
Molly's telling me we're out of time and you have better places to be. But I know you get asked about this all the time and I'm probably sick of it, but is Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants 3, is that like unofficially in development?
Make it happen, kind of? America.
It is unofficially unofficial, but it is unofficially in development. Yeah.
Okay.
That like it's happening next year.
Joey's like, yay, it's happening. The show is Hentified, and thank you so much, America Ferrera. It's great to have you here.
This has been the Jess Cagle Podcast with Julia Cunningham, a SiriusXM production. Hear new episodes every Tuesday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.